Sucks to Be You. In honor of Abigail in theaters this weekend, what is another profession, like ballerina, that should be filled by a vampire?
I'm Katie Rich, and first of all, I didn't know Abigail was about a scary thing with a job. I'm realizing I don't know what Abigail is at all. But more importantly, having recently been faced with extensive dental work for a child, let me tell you, vampires and dentistry. A is one of the scary things I can imagine, and B, the vampires would eat well.
I am Matt Patches. Which profession should a vampire fill? I'm going to say Salt Bay.
Cool. We need a
that's not a profession. That is a person.
It's a profession. It's a title passed down.
If they replace him with a different Salt Bay, you wouldn't notice.
Each major city has its own Salt Bay. They can't share that.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, and very specifically, Dan Stevens, the kaiju veterinarian, should be a vampire in the next one.
And I am David Ehrlich, and I will go with the shadow of a vampire wrote and say that an actor could be a vampire, could be in vampire films, as Willem Dafoe's Max Schreck was in Shadow of a Vampire. No one would ever know.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 471. It is the week of Wednesday, April 17th. That is the day that in 1397, Geoffrey Chaucer told the Canterbury Tales. He didn't write it down. He told it out loud at the court of English King Richard II.
Yeah.
Is like Richard II the Robin Hood one, or is that a different King Richard?
It might be the Robin Hood one. You've caught me off guard.
Is he
with your question.
A lion with a lot of jewels on his fingers, as I've been told from Disney?
Is he a Sean Connery?
I am not successfully finding Robin Hood on his Wikipedia page, so I think it's a different one.
Okay, so it's King Richard I was the Lionheart. His lion depiction.
Therefore, he was a lion, but he was the bad guy also, a lion heart of evil. Hello, we're all here. But before we get started, I hear we have some reviews. One review, and maybe some emails also. The emails have been really good lately, by the way. I've really enjoyed the ones that like don't get read on the air and just so the people who sent them know.
Shout out some names or something? I
feel like they specifically didn't want to be involved. I just want to say, thank you for sending emails. We're reading them.
Yeah. Yes. Just as a note to all listeners, if we give medical advice, please listen to your doctor over us.
That was some wise advice we received.
Yes. Yeah. So we got a good email.
Listening to Armchair Expert Dax Shepard's podcast today. Uh-huh. And like, even in the fact check segment of that show, which I greatly enjoy, they run at the mouths about all sorts of medical related maladies and advice and scientific theories that have not been fact checked. And they go out to some would say, considerably larger audience than our podcast does. And they trust that nobody has the stats to back that up. I'm just making an educated guess. But they trust that their listeners are not stupid enough to buy them hook, line, and sinker. Follow hook, line, and sinker.
Dax Shepard does it. We're allowed to do it.
You know what? That's been my policy through life, and it served me very poorly. So why change now?
We can star in the Chips remake.
The Chips remake. Yes, we have one. Yeah, the email reviews may have been great. The Apple Podcast app reviews less so. KDMDJDJDJD says aspirational. This would be a great podcast if David Ehrlich had a time or word limit. Well,
is that
if
all
you want a time limit, watch shitty new baseball, you know? I think all I have to add to that review.
Is that true? I'm sorry, I'm catching up here. This is
new baseball has a time limit.
Baseball has a time limit
as of, like a shot
as of last season.
In
yeah,
what
they have
aspect
a,
of the, like, it's a pitch throw clock. Your pitch?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which I've never enjoyed baseball, but I've always respected baseball for how painfully slow it is. And I would have to imagine
it's supposed to be leisurely. You got to go get your hot dog, come back. Yeah. They're still.
I would imagine that if I were a baseball fan, this rule change would really piss me
off.
How is Roy Hobbs supposed
to come out of right field to go all the way to the pitcher's mound to tell him not to throw the game for the judge? Or how is what's his face? Dorne supposed to tell Charlie Sheen to strike the motherfucker out, and it doesn't matter he slept with his wife.
If we have pitch clocks. To KDMD GDG KDMD DJ DJ DJD. I think I fucked it up the first time. If you want to challenge me, come find me in the arena of Marvel Snap, where I am currently the 970th ranked player on Earth with my Zemo Red Guardian deck. So
higher than you were last week when you bragged about this the first time?
Considerably.
Congratulations.
I have to see a Guy Ritchie. I've already seen a Guy Ritchie film, and I have to see the second part of Zack Snyder's magnum opus this week. So I am resorting to all sorts of life-saving measures to better focus my brain to
keep myself from going insane.
It's wild that everybody in this country is just going about their daily lives as if Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver, is not coming out this very Friday.
Some of us have been camped in line and also front of our own homes.
The chutzpah,
watch on Netflix first.
The chutzpah of Taylor Swift to release a new album on the same day where Zack Snyder had already planted his flag for the release of the second part
true?
Of Rebel Moon.
There's a new Taylor album coming up this week.
Which was determined and
what's
announced
wrong?
After.
I love this glimpse at Patch's priorities of pop culture.
Rules Taylor album.
Not knowing
here?
That there's a new Taylor album. That is impressive avoidance. I don't know. You're not paying enough attention.
I mean, this is a whole segment, but we've litigated Taylor Swift on the podcast recently, but like, it's just too much. It's just everywhere. I can't even hear it anymore. There's too much Taylor. How can you possibly add more music? Stop making music. Take a break.
Stop.
It's endless.
That patches to Taylor Swift. Give
I think
up.
Eras Tour was her endgame, and everything after this is going to be fucking Black Widow.
Oh, I see. It was her endgame, as in the Marvel movie, not the end of the planned end of her career.
She should have called it quits.
Well, maybe by the time we record next week's episode, we will have more insight into that.
Eating crow here, probably. I'm sure it'll be great.
Well, you could, of course, leave us reviews on the Apple Podcast app. We like them. Usually we like them more if they're 5 stars, but, you know, we like
them
anyway.
Speak your truth.
Yeah. We do also have an email. It's fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. We have some emails to read this week. The first one, the subject is Coquette, and the body of the email is longtime listener, first time caller, Fitwarettes. That should be the name of fans of the show.
I
like that. Fitwarettes.
It's like
where will we use that?
Thank you, Fitwarettes, for writing in.
Like, okay. Hey, Fitwarettes, weigh in on whether Patches should know things about Taylor Swift, even if he doesn't think he cares.
Do the Fitwarettes have enough financial leverage to either A, buy me a new apartment that is larger and that I don't wake up my children now every week that we record, or as I just did, my baby, who I think is just far away enough that you may not be able to pick her up on the mic, or B, buy some sort of soundproofing.
There's only one way to find
technology
out.
That I can use. Yeah,
asking, anyway. But I think you have to leave New York. I think that's the thing.
No, I'm not a coward.
It's time to
I'm
go.
Not doing
you
that.
Can't keep telling him that. He's never going to listen.
Okay, yeah. maybe just a closet and blanket space, but it'll be very uncomfortable. We have another email. This one's the subject is a letter from Dan. Greetings to the Fitwear crew. Popular actor / musician / entrepreneur Dan Aykroyd here. I'm a huge fan of the show and was very disappointed when I heard Dave's confession about pirating the latest Ghostbusters film.
Wow.
Just like a poltergeist, film piracy is no joke. It's like crossing the streams of common decency and good taste. Every illegal download is like a proton pack firing in the heart of our collective art. Remember, we ain't afraid of no pirate, but that doesn't mean we won't bust him. Your pal, Dan Aykroyd.
Wow.
Dave, you're really taking one here. Did people know what happened to you? That you couldn't physically go to a movie theater and that you paid for one, at least one of the tickets?
I feel strongly. Because I said those things at the exact same time in the exact same episode. You know what, though? I'm going to assume that listener... also knows that I don't care about Dan Aykroyd's opinion.
I'm impressed that Dan Aykroyd was able to write that much without veering off into a tangent about UFOs.
Mm. Very, very true. And then our last email for this week, the subject is you're thanked in a comic. Hello, Fitwer. I posted a review a couple of months ago saying I've been listening to episodes from back in 2015 as research for a comic I was working on. Well, the first issue is done, so I thought, since at least some of you read comics, you might want to see it. Here's a link to the PDF, and there's a link. The book is called Wet Cement. It's an atmospheric suburban horror about growing up when you know something is wrong. I've got a Kickstarter going for issue one right now at kickrichard.com. And I'm deep in production on issue 3 of 6 as part of my completely normal and healthy goal of having 300 published comics by the time I turn 40. You will get a thank you / acknowledgement on the inside cover of the print version, which I'm happy to send your way when it gets to me in May. I'm not trying to stalk any of you, but if you have a P.O. box address, let me know. Anyway, that's it. Hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoy your show, but that's a high bar. Richard Fairgray, and I will be forwarding this on to all my co-hosts so they could download the PDF if they want. But if you are interested in Wet Cement and seeing what he pulled from our podcast in 2015 that could possibly be part of the story, head to kickrichard.com and pitch in on his Kickstarter.
I applaud this person for creating something.
Yeah.
Ooh, we're creating something every week.
Are we?
Every week we're on here creating something.
I don't know. I was watching Civil War earlier this week, and I was feeling pretty useless.
We'll talk more about very soon.
That's our emails. You too can contribute to emails by emailing us at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com or, leaving us a review. But until then, let's get on with this week's show. It's the dream.
Before we started recording this segment, I sent everybody else on this podcast a picture of the 7 children in my family all watching Bluey together. In the picture, they are not watching the new 30-minute episode, The Sign, but they had just watched it, I promise. All sat down, wrapped. This is kids ranging in age from 7.5 to 2, and they all love Bluey. All kids in America love Bluey.
There's no way the 2-year-old loves Bluey. I'm sorry. It's not true.
Does.
He loves being around other kids. There's no way a 2-year-old's watching Bluey.
This is the 2-year-old my nephew who has a broken leg right now, so he's been getting a lot of screen time. I mean, I don't know that he loves Bluey.
I didn't know 2-year-olds could break their legs. Their legs are made out of vulcanized rubber.
Yeah, they are, and yet enough pressure can snap them. So word to the wise, don't let your 2-year-old be on a skateboard. Anyway, Bluey's been a fixture in my house for a while. We've talked about Bluey. And then I often realize that Dave knows more about Bluey than I do, because often it's on and I see each episode in chunks several times before I then piece together what's actually been happening in it. And Bluey is a show that has callbacks and will have like a quiet moment that kind of puts in context what you've seen. And I think there's a lot of discussion about like the level in which kids gets it and the level in which adults get it. But as I was watching The Sign, which is the 30-minute episode that may or may not be the last one ever, I was like, oh, Dave is going to get a lot of stuff out of this that I'm not. Because I can't.
We don't know that, Patches.
We absolutely know that. They have said it's not the last one ever. Now, they didn't say it's coming back for season 4, but they said Bluey is not over.
Yes, there's going to be some Bluey. It could be a movie.
This is on the record.
It could be a theme park. Okay. It could be another live show.
No, it would not be a theme park.
Why not?
Because that's not what cartoonists are talking about when they say they're going to keep Bluey going on.
None of the cartoonists have said anything. Only one producer has not said anything about more Bluey after this.
I think that if someone said there's going to be more Bluey, I was referring to a ride, people would be right to string him up by his feet in the public.
Very possible, but it has a touring show right now.
The Australian who created Bluey, is in total creative control. There was a great Bloomberg report weeks ago about the financial status of Bluey. It is a $1 billion empire. Bluey, you can buy anything with Bluey on it. There will be a Bluey theme park. As you said, there's a Bluey live show. You can do everything Bluey right now. It is full-blown entertainment property. It's Peppa Pig. But Joe Brum still owns it and still talks about it as a creative endeavor in a way that's completely different than every other kind of kid, Cocomelon or whatnot. Still a creative project. And when he and his producers say there will be more Bluey, they're talking about the show that they've created.
Yes, but
not
he
the
has
product
not,
that has grown out of
he
it.
He has not said it. We have one producer of the show that has said, no, it is not the end for Bluey. I'm sure we have many more surprises in store for you. We have more in store, and we were thinking about what would be next. That is producer talk, but we don't know what it is.
This is a very,
they want to do longer stories.
This is a very pertinent conversation to The Sign, because The Sign to me, and we can talk about the plot of the episode, that I watched on at 8 a.m. on Sunday morning.
Ungodly early and crying in my house.
I watched it with seven children,
The plot of the episode led me to suggest that, because so much of it is about whether or not they're going to sell their house. The sign is the real estate sign. It's posted on the front lawn. It's teased at the end of the previous episode, Ghost Basket. And they go back and forth. And the episode is so much about how, about the nature of luck and signs in general, really, not just this one sign, but like sometimes the example I go to is impossibly morbid, not the one that I used when I explained it to Asa, but the kind of thing of like, oh, you missed you slept in through your alarm and you're like, ugh. What was such a terrible thing? But then you didn't get on a plane that crashed in the World Trade Center. And you're like, wow, mm-hmm. I'm so happy that I slept through my alarm. This is basically the premise of this Bluey episode, where all these bad, ostensibly bad things happen. And then we realize that they could have good signs and vice versa. And the message around that is like, yes, it's very traumatizing to move for these kids and to leave their lives, but it could lead them towards this greater happiness. Or maybe, choosing not to move and for the dad to take this higher paying job somewhere else is going to be the right thing. And they waffle back and forth and back and forth at the very end in a deus ex machina that sort of fits the theme of the episode. They end up not moving. And to me, it read like... My meta interpretation was them saying, because is there going to be more Bluey? Is there not going to be more Bluey? Do you want there to be more Bluey? Should we end it on the right terms? And at the end of it, they said, sort of reluctantly, there will be more Bluey, but you may regret it.
Like, can't say no to $1 billion empire.
That really felt like the takeaway. Like, you think it's a good thing there will be more Bluey, if there is indeed more Bluey, but maybe you will wish there wasn't.
The episode I found very affecting, telling your kids they're going to move, ripping yourself out of the known world you've created. And I think Bluey has been extremely successful in building characters over how many episodes? There's like 100 some episodes now, right?
At least
kind of like 4 or 5 minutes. So
they're 8 minutes. How dare you?
Eight, whatever.
Don't be a
have you
Joe
never
Brunswick.
Measured time in Blueys?
Have you
like,
never,
hey,
like,
two more Blueys and it's time to go to bed?
Too quickly.
Or like you have one Bluey left before school. Like this is every day.
But what I was getting at is like, even in those short bursts, you get to really know the characters. There's, I wouldn't call it lore like a geek, but there's history to this world. And when you see all the characters pop up, because there's a wedding happening in this episode, you really feel like, oh, you're about to leave your whole existence. And we know the house really well. I've always been envious of the Bluey house and these two people can afford such an amazing place and they get to go to the beach really quickly. I don't know. I'm so jealous of everything.
I think the beach is an Australian thing. But yes, the house is amazing.
But the twist, I guess, in my personal reaction, as I said, I was like sitting there with my kids bawling a little bit. I get very emotional when kids are being torn out of their lives. I thought they didn't go they needed to move. They cheaped out. This is a bad ending.
I had this thought. Yeah.
Mm.
It's not the show to have done this. And I hate complaining about a kid's show, but like, they kind of chickened out, right? David, seems like what you're getting at too, that you can feel them being like, we have to keep going. No, it's not that we want to.
They talk in the episode about, you know, happy endings and sad endings. The idea that, you know, there are so many sad endings in life. And so we tell stories because they have happiest, so that we can have happy endings. And that, you know, is sort of paving the way for this contrived happy ending at the story. I do think that, you know, if this was the last episode and it ended with, Bluey and Bingo being torn away from their town with really no upside, you know, other than this sort of abstract idea that maybe it would be a good thing for them in the long run, kids would have been devastated. I don't really think you can do that.
Michael Haneke at home being like, oh, yes, Bluey.
Yeah. Is he masturbating in that scenario? Was that what you were just doing?
Yeah, that was a clap.
I was looking down for a second, but I have questions. I think they couldn't have gone that route. I don't think it was dramatically satisfying, even though thematically it makes sense in the context of the episode, how it comes to pass that they don't move. But dramatically, It's kind of just like, yeah, I guess we're not moving. Like, you've already moved all the shit out of your house. Like, that's what drove me crazy.
Is he going to quit his job he just got and then try and get his old job back? He already got a new job.
There are a lot of logistical questions that I struggle with here.
But he did it for the kids. This is the other thing. Maybe this is true to Bluey, because every episode of Bluey is, I can't possibly be this level of parent. I can't be this good to my kids. So the ultimate Bluey act would be to say you're moving for your job, something you would definitely do if you were getting paid more money because you are a human. But these dogs are so much better than you at parents. They will quit their new job and they will cancel their plans to make more money and have a nicer house.
Haven't like the paperwork been signed by this point? Like these other dogs, you know, with the hair over their eyes, see this other house
with
the
no
pool,
eyes.
And then they're like, you know, we're going to want that one instead.
You can move out of your house.
You have like the escrow period.
Yeah, exactly.
This is what will happen if you ever move to the suburbs, David.
I would have loved a Bluey episode, or at least a sidebar where they try to explain escrow to children. That would have been fantastic. But, you know, it was a fun episode. I do think it is, especially because the fate of the show is unknown, the ambivalence of the way the episode structured is a little bit strange, but Asa seemed to like it. If you wanted to watch it again today.
My argument for the twist at the end of it is because it's basically Bandit saying, like, we're going to have a better life, and the rest of his family being like, there isn't a better life. Like, we have what is a better life. So there's it's the idea of, like, that I think comes up a lot in Bluey. It's like, you realize what you're focused on for the sake of your kids is not necessarily the thing that really is for the sake of your kids. Like, being there, being present in the world that you have is better for them. And that's the realization he comes to there.
The thing, I don't want to bring too much to bear on this kid show, but when you talk, like,
we're already doing that.
I think that's like a very perceptive take. However, the healers are fucking rich already. Like, it's not like, oh, we're finally going to have money and I can give these girls everything they want. They live in I've played the Bluey video game. That house is fucking enormous. They have more money than God already. So, you know, I think Bandit is being a little bit jealous. Lawn. Being a little bit greedy to think that more money is going to bring more happiness here.
Dave, what did you make of it? You didn't watch it with children,
right?
And you have no children to care for.
And yet again, correct. I think Dave knows more about Bluey than I do. Usually.
I was
because he has no children. It's on the Reddit all day long.
It wasn't until the second time through that I was asking a lot of the questions you guys were asking about what does the ending mean? Because the first time through, I was pumping my fist in the air. Because way back in the episode, I think it's called like TV Shop, but it was like 6 episodes back, I was like, oh my god, is Winton's dad gonna get together with the terrier mom? And the fact that that is sort of like the one of the things that makes up the deus ex machina in this episode.
Idea what you're talking about. I feel like I have seen every Bluey and I have no idea what you're talking about.
Winton's dad is divorced.
Who's Winton?
The little bulldog kid at school.
Like one of the kids at school? Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in the episode where they're telling their stories, he's the one that wants to have muscles and shoot rainbows out of his... okay. That's Winton. So Winton and his dad were in the season 3 episode, I think it was called like Television Store or something like that, where they're at the store and they're looking for their friend at the pharmacy and all the kids kind of help. And there's a background story where Winton's dad is sort of like talking to the mother of the terriers. The terriers are the 3 terriers.
Sure.
And I was like, oh, I hope they get together. Because at the end of that, it shows everybody's cars and Winton's dad car as one of those like mom, dad, child stick figures on the back. And someone scraped off the mom because after the divorce, I guess things haven't been going that well.
Wow.
And so Winton brings that up at the beginning of the sign. And then at the end... Winton's dad is apparently going to move in with the terriers because they abandoned that house, and that's the house with the pool that the dogs with no eyes get to look at. So I was like, everything's coming together, and based on this one thing that I was really kind of invested in as a backstory.
When parents watch Bluey with their kids, parents are looking at their phones because it's the one chance that they get to do that. And so we don't catch up on these details.
I'm often watching from in the kitchen and kind of wandering in and out.
Whereas like Dave is like Rust Cole watching Bluey.
The first time I saw the sign, I had completely missed the coin and the binoculars thing. So I was like, why are these people on a mountain? What is going on? I thought it was like a time jump. I didn't know what was happening. So yes, it was good to watch it a second time without my children.
There's lots of cool stuff in it. I definitely like it. If it is the last, you know, or if
what do you think they'll really do, though?
Well, there's been rumors that there's actually one more episode in season three, and it's actually called Surprise. So, it's very possible that all of a sudden there's just an episode called Surprise at the end of the summer or something. And then along with that comes an announcement of whatever they're doing next. That's what I think is actually happening. I think we're in, they're making the most of their marketing moment by keeping us sort of on tenterhooks here, but which is good.
But there has to be an end in sight, just because they're faced with a problem that a lot of shows, particularly animated shows, aren't, which is that the girls who voice the two lead characters are soon going to age out of being able to do that.
But I don't think that's a problem for Bluey. It's a problem for any other animated show, except I think Bluey would age the characters up and be a new show.
That is a possibility. Either way, the sign definitely completed in 2021. You could look at the copyright date at the end of the episode.
Wow.
Surprise also completed in 2021.
What?
So this isn't a sudden decision.
2021?
Yes. This isn't a decision that's been forced upon them.
Was the rest of season three completed in 2021?
Yeah. They've just been doling it out little bit by little bit.
Wow.
I assume to, accurately plan what's happening, but this is like, they've been thinking about it for years and years. And so people are like, oh, they're just taking a break. They've taken a break. I expect something by the end of the year in terms of what form Bluey takes next.
Because this has been like preserved in amber. Like there's been no absorption of fan reaction to the show whatsoever. It was made in a vacuum 3 years ago.
That is basically when Bluey was far less popular than it is now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like the episode Stickbird, which a lot of people have assumed that like Bandit's sort of existential crisis he's having on the beach that episode is a metaphor for them realizing Bluey's big 2021 problems. Now Bandit would be having like an existential freak out, I'm sure. So there will be some sort of new Bluey. How cheeky they're being about it, right now is yet to be seen, but I'm convinced is part of making the most of this moment in case this is peak Bluey, which it might be. Who knows what's going to happen.
I feel completely fine if this is the end of Bluey. I love the show. I feel like they
should have been
do so much more, so much with it, but. Yeah, I mean, all of those episodes live on forever. We've all seen most of them multiple times and will continue to. Like, it's okay for this to be the end.
What 2 weeks for animated Disney Plus, though. Good job, guys.
Yeah, what was Jubilee the other thing? Told me to stop being nostalgic and move on from my life in X-Men 97. And then Bluey's like, no, stay home with your kids. Ah,
who do I listen to? Jubilee or Bluey?
Jubilee.
Okay, well, so for our mini segment tonight, we're talking about how the New York Rangers have won the President's Trophy this year as the most successful team in the regular season.
We're talking about the Masters, which Katie and I watched in Texas. We're old now. We watch golf.
Yeah. Now, that truly is boring.
I mean, I was at the Masters, so I don't know if you had the same experience than I did.
I would love Masters. To do a segment sometime on taking Asa to his first Ranger game, which we did over the weekend, which is really an experience that I was anxious about for a very long time.
And how did it turn out?
Just off the rails here. Don't ask him how it turned out. We're never going to get to the topic.
Okay,
it was spectacular. I'll spare you that. My anxiety was for nothing. We're here to talk about the only thing anyone in America is talking about right now. That's right. Guy Ritchie.
The Guy Ritchie.
When people I know heard that I was going to the world premiere of The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare last night, they said, what is that?
They fucking fell over with excitement.
And I said, I don't know. But
it's going straight to Amazon Prime in the UK. But here in the US, David, we get it in theaters.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. Over the summer, I think.
Over the summer. I didn't know that. It kind of checks out because... and we'll loop back around to this later in the segment, I think, but it is a middle budget Lionsgate movie It is, you know, the pinnacle of, or at least the epitome of this era, of the prolific era of Guy Ritchie's career, his post-Man of U.N.C.L.E. era, where he is just churning out mid-budget things that vary in quality and cheekiness. And he already has another one with all many
like
of the same...
He's just going, experiment.
Exactly like Soderbergh. I don't know if experimenting is the word that I would use, but he has...
Well, some movies are in the desert, and some movies are in London, and, you know, experimentation.
He has another movie in the can that also has the same cast as this movie does. This, you know, this movie is his Inglourious Basterds. It is set during World War II. It's about sort of a wrecking crew of, you know, rogues and absolutely shredded British dudes who blow shit up and slash Nazi throats while, you know, never flinching and just cracking jokes and calling each other old chap and shit like that. It
sounds great.
I mean, the problem with the movie and is that it doesn't feel as much of a Guy Ritchie movie as Guy Ritchie movies of yore did. And the reason it doesn't do that is because there are a lot of limitations on what he's able to do with the kind of budget that he's given here to make this, you know, big steroidal period epic. It's based on a true story. And I said in my review that it's like based on a true story in that like World War II was a thing that happened.
And,
like
that. And there were books to be taken over.
And there are historical figures in the movie. And one of them definitely being Winston Churchill, who is used as sort of a Nick Fury like figure here. For me, this movie really felt like, you know, if we were still doing cinematic universes and if anyone was going to go see this film, could have been the start of a potentially fun cinematic universe. Ian Fleming is in it. You know, among other historical figures.
Is the rule it's people who had to be really alive during World War II, or are they just throwing famous people at the ball?
Some of the characters are historical figures who were to a degree involved in Operation Postmate, which is what this is based on. And then some of the characters are just made up, but the circumstances around the operation, how it's pulled off, it's all movie magic. You know, what are the names of these people? It's all, you know, all your favorites. The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, a title that takes up the entire SEO bar in your CMS. you know, you have Henry Cavill. You know, the one person who really jumped out at me was Alan Richson, who plays Reacher.
Oh, yeah, Reacher. He's such a big man. He's great.
Truly, I have not found reason to use this expression since it was ubiquitous like 3 or 4 years ago. I could think of no other way to describe this man than to call him an absolute unit. I mean, like, he is the largest mammal I have ever seen in my life.
Do you watch Reacher? Have we ever talked about Reacher on the podcast?
No, I don't watch Reacher.
Pretty entertaining.
How many seasons into that are we? Has it been on for two seasons?
No.
Okay.
Well, what's weird is it feels like it's been on for so long because season two jumps ahead to like feel like you've been with the group the whole time and you really care, which you don't. Sorry.
So you've been watching all of Reacher. Wow.
I recently saw Alan Richson in as the lead role of like a very sad, widowed father in a faith-based Christian movie. And I was like, oh, okay. Like that's what he does when he's not snapping necks on Reacher. But then recently he's sort of defied my very presumptuous idea of who he is by coming out swinging against a certain arm of the Republican religious right. And so, you know, he's back. We are so back with Alan Richson. I had a lot of fun watching him this movie. He's like a very sweet bear of a man who also like takes extraordinary smiling pleasure in ripping the hearts out of Nazis, like physically ripping their hearts out and like runs around with a bow and arrow, Legolas style. He's a lot of fun to watch. You got your Isaac Gonzalez's fresh out of Three Body Problem. Henry Golding as a pyromaniac explosives detective. You have Jamis from Dune, Babs Olusanmokun, who
Jamis
I really really
is a person in Dune.
Yeah, he's the guy who to me
kills. Well, I mean, he's dead at the beginning of part two, but you see
the
him
guy
in
they're
flashback.
Like dragging through the
but,
desert.
Man, that guy cuts an impression fast. I mean, like really well cast in Dune. You have to remember him, even though he does come back in Dune part two. You have to remember him in Dune 1. You do. And he is a lot of fun to watch in like a side movie where he's paired up with Isaac Gonzalez trying to seduce a Nazi. in West
Africa.
Are
they both trying to seduce the same Nazi?
No, he's like her handler, and she's trying. I mean, that would be the Challengers.
That'd be much more interesting.
The Challengers version of this film. But, you know, it's Guy Ritchie is trying to make fun Guy Ritchie movies in the paradigm that this business allows him to work now, where, you know, the movies are made at a fraction of what they would need to be afforded for him to really flex his muscles and give an his oomph into Inglourious Basterds. And I feel like he sort of resigned himself to the fact that his ceiling is going to be a six, and he is going to just make another movie every 9 months and hope for the best. And
they do all kind of deliver. I mean, they're not two, you know, I don't think he's really missed since
this is
Aladdin. And I would defend King Arthur and Man of Uncle. Like he delivers
Man
entertainment.
Man from Uncle is great.
I think you should go to prison for defending King Arthur, but I think otherwise
one of the great
is,
scores of the 2010s.
Well, that's one thing, but I think otherwise your point is well taken. I think this is definitely a solid 5.8 when it works as it does in like the first 30 minutes in particular, when they're doing raids and laughing as Nazis board their ship because they know that they're indestructible. It's a lot of fun. And the score is pounding. It's not your same guy who did the King Arthur score, but
where do you fall on? I mean, have you kept up with Ritchie stuff of the last few years?
Yeah, I've seen them all.
Like Wrath of Man is
Wrath of Man is, we
were making fun of him for not experimenting, but that's an experimentation for him. He loses all the Guy Ritchie-ness to try and do something
in a way.
Brutal.
Like structurally, there's still some Guy Ritchie-ness there, but stylistically, maybe not. But
Operation Fortune, tremendous plane movie. I think it's the number one thing to watch that has Jason Statham and Aubrey Plaza.
Yeah, and I saw
just yucking it up.
I saw the one with Jake Gyllenhaal, like
The Covenant.
The Covenant.
It's actually, apparently, according to Wikipedia, it's Guy Ritchie's The Covenant.
Is that the one where it's like him in Afghanistan?
Yes, it's a serious film.
But, you know, he is sort of accepted his lane. He does not, you know, his only ambition is to keep working and making these sixes out of tens. And it's fun watching, you know, the problem is this, the entire second half of the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, it's certainly the final act, the climactic thing where they're trying to blow up and or steal these boats, is all shot under, like, completely obfuscated cover of darkness. Like, you cannot tell a single fucking thing that is happening, and it drove me insane. And they joke earlier about the best scene in the movie, right before the best scene in the movie, they're plotting this raid and they're planning to do it in the dead of night, and I'm like, oh, please don't. And then fucking Reacher just starts killing guys, so they have to go right there in the middle of the day, and it rules. But we get our comeuppance at the end of the movie. But I mean, like, it's frustrating because there is potential here for at least a seven, you know, for sequels that are maybe a little bit more muscular if there are any shirts in the world large enough to contain those kind of pecs, you know, where like you could cycle in because at the end of this movie, they clear the oceans of U-boats by eliminating the U-boat supply chain so the Americans can enter the fray. And so you could have fucking George Clooney showing up as Clark Gable and like wanting to join the fucking Churchill Initiative, whatever. I mean, like, there are all sorts of shit.
That happen?
No, absolutely
okay,
not.
Just
are,
look,
you, are you saying the movie needed that? That's not what the movie
does. No,
we're
saying it could sequelize.
No, I'm saying that like there is the potential here, just as there's potential for this one movie to have been better, and it's frustrating that the potential will never be realized. And so, you know, the fun of going to the theater with your boys and seeing Guy Ritchie, you know, hit a solid single is sort of diminished by the feeling that it should be at least a double. But
he's not operating like Jean Collet Serra at the nonstop.
No, but he's also not operating like Jean Collet Serra at the bottom of his game where he's been recently. So
he's delivering. He is unpretentious. I've been dipping into our friends on the Blank Check podcast. They're talking about McTiernan right now, and I'm thinking about like what is the bar for unpretentiousness? When do you sail under it and you make schlock, or when do you shoot pure entertainment and you're good at it? And I do think, looking back at Ritchie's output, he's above the bar.
There's not pretentious bone in his body. He's a genuine lad. You know, he just wants to make.
We're approaching the Scar Giver, and that would be disastrous. You know, pretension. Someone who thinks he's creating pure art.
We're approaching the Scar Giver.
Unlike Zack Snyder, he has made a movie that would leave audiences wanting more. Which is not something I can say about any Zack Snyder movie I've ever seen. So, I guess that's the silver lining there. But I wish the ecosystem were different. I wish that Lion, but this is the Lionsgate business. So, you know, they're the STX entertainment of
Guy Ritchie has a movie in the can and one shooting right now. Yeah. He's not stopping.
Anyway, the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, if anything about it, what I said about it sounds appealing, you know, get your fellas, go to the movies this weekend, have a good time. I use fellas as guys. your fellas of any gender.
Not lads. I feel like this is a prime time to say.
Get your lads.
Jumping up and down the floor. My hat is an animal. And once there was an animal, it had a song that mowed the lawn.
To wrap up tonight, we're going to talk about a movie that a lot of people are talking about. I hope a lot of people who are talking about it have seen it. It's called Civil War. It's actually doing okay at the box office right now. I believe it's A24. Let me check
with
an employee.
I would say
David is A20. This was A24's biggest opening of all time.
It's their widest release ever and their biggest opening weekend.
Yeah, at the multiplex I saw it at today, it was on like five of the screens in the multiplex. Like it is
not a whole lot else
huge. Wide. No, there's not.
Yeah,
it's
definitely benefiting from the fact that we are in a barren time for new releases. It also had a lot of IMAX money coming in, the premium ticket prices, sure, and so on.
But this is the new one from Alex Garland, who really was on my map after 28 Days Later, writing that for Danny Boyle. And then they worked on Sunshine. Then he wrote Dread and I think had to take over that movie and shoot the rest of it. That's my understanding. And then really blew up as a director with Ex Machina. Annihilation. Do we like Annihilation? That was a million years ago in podcast.
By far, my favorite of his movies.
He did Men. I don't even know if we talked about that one. Pretty polarizing for people. And now we're here with Civil War. Where to begin with this one? This is a discourse bomb for sure. People were livid. They could not understand what the politics of this movie were going to be when they saw the trailers. They really needed it spelled out. And then when they saw the movie, they were also disappointed that the president, played by
Nick Offerman.
Nick Offerman, Parks and Rec. I guess he's done a million things since then, including an Alex Garland FX TV show. But I'll still say he's from Parks and Rec. This president, who they say has dismantled the FBI, doesn't ring a bell at all. But no, the politics of this movie were not clear enough. People were just really, really mad. But I got to say, when I saw it earlier this week, I didn't think about the politics a lot. Like, I understand, maybe, and that's because all the discourse was before me, and I didn't have to think about that. I could go in just ready to see whatever Garland was cooking up. For me, I was watching New York get bombed because
Brooklyn gets the fakest looking Brooklyn you've seen.
Atlanta-ish Brooklyn
gets suicide bombed because that is in Alex Garland's, you know, galaxy brain, sort of the ultimate visual expression, sure, of America in tatters.
They come to you, progressive. But yeah, like watching Brooklyn get bombed, watching missiles fly over New York, and then watching fires burning in New Jersey. I was watching my home be attacked, and I felt very unsettled by it in a way that I think the mission of this movie is extremely clear. We are shown images of war happening all over the world and almost and never here in America, and what would it look like? I found it to be pretty straightforward and viscerally upsetting. I was just very unnerved by this story about not the politics of the Civil War, not really the army, even though we spend most of the time following the military. This is about war photographers. This is about journalists, a job that I would probably be very bad at, not one. I don't know how you get press credentials during the American Civil War and how you kind of like run with squads.
A lot of things are unclear about
that. Be in their way, frankly. Just get out of the way. I'm shooting a war here.
I heard an interesting idea about why they are so close to the action, especially towards the end. I think it was from Sean Fennessy on the Big Pick podcast. But it's this idea that if the insurgency gets close to winning, they actually want the press like in the front lines, because the media is more valuable to an insurgency win than it is to the old guard sort of like taking over and recontrolling the media.
We'll we'll talk about the ending and maybe we can bang the spoiler gong, but at some point. But yeah, the last image is very much a take my victory photo, and really commanding these journalists in a way to, you know, end but this thing Patches, on a media level.
You keep referring to not thinking about the politics of the movie as if when you were seeing the movie, it did have clear politics. But I think one of the biggest things about it that people are mad about is that it doesn't. It did very aggressively tries to blur the lines in terms, not just in terms of who's a good guy, the bad guy. It's not really concerned with that, but just like how any of the reality outside of this very small group of characters works.
But that's because I mean, I think the politics of the movie are successful in that they are not spelling out circumstance. They are emotional politics. They are an emotional logic to the political moment we're in. I couldn't stop thinking about the election.
Really?
During this movie. I could not stop thinking about, in a few months, we're going to have an election in the country where no matter who wins, all hell is going to break loose.
As they Matt famously Patches said in about Alien vs. Predator, whoever wins, we lose.
And I just want to be clear, I'm not part of this chaos that's erupting.
I'm really starting to think about Tracy Jordan being on Larry King, being like, New York City as we know it will no longer exist tomorrow. No one take advice from Matt Patches on how to plan for your future.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting it. I'm just like, no matter what happens, it's going to be nutso.
It's not going to be any fun.
No, and I can't help but look at this vision, and it doesn't have to be politically sensical even. I know people complain about, like, California and Texas are teaming up. I just don't think the circumstances matter. What matters is the divisions between people in the American society in being depicted in this film is so vast, the chasm between them is so vast that, like, it came to this. And at this point in the film, when we pick up with the war photographers, they're years into it. Like, I got the impression that, so the main character is Kirsten Dunst. She's a longtime war photographer, and they make mention that she kind of blew up and became a famous war photographer for taking a picture of, I believe, something like the Antifa massacre.
Yeah.
And the politics of this movie are not clear.
Yeah, exactly. Who knows what side... Were they being massacred or were they doing the massacring? This movie is not interested in answering that question for you.
And why would it? I mean... I guess, let me turn the table. I'm doing a lot of talk here. Was this affecting to all of you? I've seen the Letterboxd scores, but now I'm going to force you to dig in and tell me I was unnerved, and the war, like, action stuff is also really terrifying, but this movie is not playing for everyone. And I'm curious, like, why not?
I want to hear from Katie Rich first.
I was unnerved by it. I spent the entire movie kind of being like, I would like for this to be over, please. I do not enjoy spending time in this world. But I think less than the politics, like the California Texas thing couldn't matter less to me. I think it's interesting that the point of that is that it's not supposed to be like, oh, you're going to figure out who you're going to identify with. It's like a war as hell kind of thing. But the message that, like, the point of all of this is what I got really stuck on. It's like, we're seeing war photographers, we're seeing people who kind of live off of the thrill of that. And I guess at the end of that, we're like, oh, that's probably not a great way to live your life. But also the entire, like, war photographers obviously do essential work, but in, like, a modern world that we live in, most of the images we get from wars come from people with cell phones. And it's unclear, like, why those people aren't doing any of this stuff. Like, where their photography is going is unclear.
There's, like, no Wi-Fi or cell signal.
Someone's phone went off twice in the movie. And the first time I was like, oh, someone's phone is ringing. Something's going to change. So I was like, oh, no, it's just that guy. I think the vagueness of the context around them hampers the point of these characters that we're following. Like, we don't know who's going to publish their stuff, who's reading it, what impact it's going to have. If the people, like, they talk about their parents pretending the war's not happening, like, is the populace impossible to reach? Like, you see these people kind of risking everything for this supposedly noble outward goal, but it's so focused on, like, their emotions that it feels really limited in the scope of its purpose, despite, like, how much money it costs and how vast it is and how far they travel and some really impressive sequences to capture all of that stuff. It feels really kind of hollow when you get to the end of it. Like, what did we go through all of this for? And maybe that's part of the point, but I just feel like it could have gone in some other direction in some other way to get more of that across. And I like this movie overall. My Letterboxd score was 3.5 for those of you keeping track.
Thank you for clarifying. Just to lay it out here. So this is something I was trying to figure out during the whole movie, and maybe I missed it. Kirsten Dunst and Wagner Moura, who I think is awesome in this movie.
He is awesome.
Total movie star. Want to see him more stuff. He's losing his damn mind by the end of it. The two of them work for Reuters.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Okay. Yeah.
And Kaylee Spaney, who plays Jesse, the young photographer, is she employed or is she just doing this for like freelance?
This is what she wants to do with her life.
Unclear. She's
yeah,
like
that's
an
rough.
Intern, a self a volunteering intern, basically.
And then Stephen McKinley Henderson,
New York Times,
cut from Dune 2, Rude
is
here and playing like the New York Times guy, the elder statesman that they drag along.
Yes.
I think they make fun of him for working at the Times, right? Or is something like that.
They do say at one point, like, whatever's left
what's
of the
left
New York
of the New York Times,
Times.
Yeah.
Ha ha. Failing New York Times. Eh. That's not me. That was my Donald Trump impression. It was a really bad one.
Meh. See?
But, like, none of this matter. Yet my mind was wondering where they were working and how this world works. And yet, I didn't leave feeling upset or like that this was hollow. I felt like it was percussive and that.
But what did you feel like you took from it? Like, was there an emotional takeaway or a mental takeaway from it?
I mean, my mental takeaway is like, how am I going to survive this when it happens?
Oh my God. Oh my God.
That's an interesting takeaway from this movie.
Patches is
absolutely the prepper of Fighting in the War Room. I think, you know, if I didn't know better, I would have assumed that it would be Dave. But
see,
it's the
opposite. I'm not a prepper. I'm like, oh, fuck, it's coming. And there's not. I'm a fatalist. I can't do anything.
Here's what I would
say.
But
this reaction I'm having is this movie is Jaws for living in America.
Jaws for living in America with the
Jaws
mayor being
Jaws
like, keep the
metaphor.
Beach open money. To answer your question, David, I'm absolutely going to die at the beginning of the apocalypse holding the door open for somebody. I'm just at peace with that.
A gentleman to the very end.
What's my apocalypse plan? Die early, doing something that hopefully has something more meaningful.
Drinking your last Baja Blast.
Drinking my last the last Baja Blast. That's my goal. I want to be the one who drinks the last Baja Blast. This movie.
I'm just picturing the Children of Men line, like whoever is the last one, you know, turn off the light. It's like,
yeah.
Whoever's the last one.
Drink
the last
Baja
Blast.
Baja Blast. Yeah, definitely the Michael Caine who's protecting the weed and the Baja Blast in that situation. here for Civil War, I think the more Alex Garland directs movies, the less he actually has something to say because he's very good at provoking conversation. And I think this is a movie that when people see it are going to come out with a wide variety of opinions. And the most fun I've had with it so far is reading opinions or talking to my friends who saw it about what they actually ended up getting out of it. What did I get out of it? Basically nothing. The magic trick this is trying to pull on you is putting a lot of war imagery that at least I saw a lot of in post 9/11 cinema in your Children of Men to bring that up again, or even like your Jarheads to put it in the Middle East where we usually see this type of imagery. But this sort of like war is hell and nonsensical and a waste of human life to try to shock audiences by setting it in America, but snapping all of politics so you can't actually picture it happening in America. I think you have to connect a lot of dots. Like whoever wins this election in November, chaos is going to reign. Those are the dots you need to connect as an audience member to really be afraid of this. Otherwise, it's pretty basic bitch war storytelling, guys. Like, the characters are pretty two-dimensional to me. About halfway through the movie, once I realized the movie had a morality that was going to allow certain characters to die, like, if you emotionally distance yourself too much, if you're an Asian man and you show up, if you are not abiding by the rules of the road, even though the fucking road is like Mad Max should be, all those
should
things.
Be? You want road chaos?
I'm saying all those things
are. You want
are,
lawlessness?
First of all, there. If this were to happen in America, there would be so much more road chaos in this movie. But that's neither here nor there. The point is, the movie storytelling, the script, is putting a morality on who lives and who dies. And because of that, a lot of those things really start being telegraphed, I think, towards the end of the movie. And I do think that the ending shot is probably the closest thing to a novel point of view that this movie has, or I guess maybe the last ending scene. But for the most part, I was a little bored. Not to say that it isn't like some beautiful filmmaking. I think Kirsten Dunst is really elevating something that absolutely...
Oh, we should talk about her.
Like, she's elevating something to a real character that I'm convinced on the page is not actually there. Natalie Portman, like, you might say. I think Alex Garland does really good with a single male protagonist who's thrown into an episodic situation where he has to learn about the world around him as he moves through it. I think that's his sweet spot as a screenwriter and a filmmaker. And I think this one, although interesting once you see it, is like straight down the middle for me. It's not great. It's not bad. I'm glad people who do see it want to come out talking about it. I think that's how we should react to all movies. But I think the way that the sort of press tour has treated this as somehow dangerous or shocking is really bringing up Death of the Artist to me, because I'm like, Alex Garland, I don't think you saw the movie that you made, which is a fine movie, but is not what you are selling it as a statement on anything, really.
Yeah, I'm torn because, you know, the kind of quotes that are extrapolated from these pre-release interviews and drive the discourse keep websites like the one that employs me alive, but they also make me want to put a gun in my mouth. Anyway, my big take on this movie is, and one of the reasons I've always been fascinated by Alex Garland's work and was looking forward to this one, is that I feel like he's compelled by failures of the imagination. I mean, this is what drives the speculative fiction. He is, you know, he made Ex Machina, sort of about a failure to believe that a android you would want to fuck, who could like pass the Turing test. And Annihilation is sort of about the failure to, because there are all these women going to the Shimmer, and they all have this very holistic sense of self-identity and their own agendas, and they find themselves sort of struggling to grasp the idea that all molecules are connected and we're all part of everything else, and they are losing their identity. And it's a fascinating process to watch, and you see this theme played out in Men to some degree. And like, here you have a movie that I think is most explicitly about failure of imagination of all of his films. That it's, you know, the whole thing that's trying to rub in our face and put a stick in our eye is like, what if war, but here in this country where our exceptionalism makes us believe that these images of war that we've been, you know, receiving for, you know, centuries now belong to some other place, that like, you know, anything like the whole idea of starting with a suicide bombing in Brooklyn, you're like, sure, suicide bombings happen all the time, but in Brooklyn, that's where I get my avocado toast. That could never happen. You know, like the whole movie is this. It's trying to deal with that dissonance between like a war, the war, the language of war, the vernacular of war that we know from life and movies, transplanted onto a territory where we think, in finger quotes, it shouldn't be. And I think that the problem with that is that it, one, clashes with how arbitrary and poorly defined the war itself is, and two, because of one, it becomes not only a movie that is about the failure of our imagination, it becomes, I think for me, a movie that is a failure of the imagination, and that, I think, is ultimately what sucked the life out of it for me. And I was actually bored. I mean, bored is maybe not the right word, because it's so concussive. And then like, whenever you may be disengaging with the narrative, suddenly Jesse Plemons shows up in that whole terrifying ordeal. and I mean, I love all the actors in this movie, even if I don't think they're given anything interesting to do, Kirsten Dunst included. But yeah, I was very restless. I don't think that, you know, I think this is the least interesting application he's found for trying to show audiences or like confront audiences with this idea that, you know, the things that we can't imagine are the defining elements of our future. And I don't think that journalists, even though they obviously play into that theme and like how they're distanced from their subjects by this pane of glass. I mean, one of the most telling shots of the movie is right in the beginning, where Kirsten Dunst is taking pictures of President Ron Swanson on television, you know, with her camera, and she's mediated once by the television and another by her camera lens. And it's like, why is she taking this picture at all? Mm-hmm. But, you know, the movie is very meditative about the distance between the reality of the conflict and the characters themselves. You see this in the town where the woman runs the clothing shop and trying to pretend as if the war isn't even happening. Even though if she just looked up, she'd see the snipers on the roof and all of their parents are off on farms somewhere trying to put their heads in the sand.
Yeah, Colorado farms.
I mean, but like, I
would spend the Civil War there. Thank you very much.
I disagree with the idea the movie isn't saying anything. I just don't think that it finds anything interesting to say about this sort of mental distance and the separation from the possibility of what's happening or what is currently happening in the world, and the experience of where we are now. I thought a little bit about the zone of interest. I'm not drawing a parallel between, you know, the parents of these characters sticking their heads in the sand and the commandant family at Auschwitz, you know, pretending that they don't live next to Auschwitz. But I think, you know, the movie is interested in similar terms and about distance. And
does the movie need to be up, does Garland need to be interested in these micro details? Can the purpose and intent of the movie be, I need to put these images on screen, I need people to feel this here,
but whereas
like what other movie has done
feel,
that why did we feel
did
like
you feel anything official? Like, first of all, everyone's pretending as if this is the first movie where people were shot up in the White House. I mean, yes, the context is different here.
We're not
here,
talking
but
about
like,
White House down here. This is not the intent.
But what
here.
Else? Like, what else is meant to resonate? We have a fake ass Brooklyn. We have the idea of like, oh look, there are some people with machine guns torturing someone at a gas station that looks like it could be the gas station down the road from your house. I mean, maybe I've played too many video games in post-apocalyptic America in my day,
yeah.
But like, that doesn't really blow my mind. I'm not like, wow, I've never considered that that could actually happen here. And then we're all not just playing pretend. Like, it felt very facile to me in that sense. And because there was so little to grab onto in the characters, it really left me with nothing to do but focus on how facile it felt. And I was basically just annoyed by the time it was over.
I don't completely disagree, but I do think that's what makes the Jesse Plemons scene sort of stand out, is like that type of chaos agent as he's represented. Where, like, not only are we not paying attention to, like, necessarily who's part of, you know, the Western Alliance or whatever, or the traditional United States or whatever the fuck Florida's doing, but there's just, like, these guys making mass graves and you don't know what they represent. Maybe they're just out to, like, kill people. That was the thing that was most interesting to me, because that seems the most individually America. Like, that scene is the one that doesn't work in Jarhead for me, you know, the like sort of nihilist in the middle of a civil war that is just using it as an excuse to kill people.
You remember a scene
like
from Jarhead?
I mean, I picked Three Kings desert movie, but like, yeah, so that works for me in a way that I think the other ones don't. I do think there's that one showdown that cuts to the De La Soul track. That does have like the, you know, kind of terrifying thought that, you know, there's something warlike in a showdown, but there are no prisoners of war. The losing side in every skirmish just gets executed. I think that sort of stuff is terrifying. But it's like in between segments where it's like we're driving through a forest fire and looking at the embers in slow motion being like, this couldn't happen anywhere. And I'm like, they're forest fucking everywhere.
Okay, that part was dumb.
I mean,
it wasn't dumb. I mean, it just was. It didn't contribute to the. I mean, I get hung up sounding like I need this movie to have a message. I need Alex Garland to tell us that war is bad. Like, that's not really the point of this.
Maybe doesn't know if war is.
I don't know, and Alex Garland
someone
won't
tell
me. I just
I
like.
Think,
yeah, sorry. Go ahead, yeah, Dave.
No, I think that we are supposed to have Alex Garland wants us to have these conversations amongst ourselves and with ourselves. And whether or not you think that is a reason for a movie to exist, for A24 to spend the most they've ever spent on a movie to be like, what did you think? I think that's sort of that's the discourse we're seeing, or that's the disconnect we're seeing in people sort of reviewing this movie. Because I think it's a fine practice. It's just, it's not as refined as I would hope it would be for the amount of exposure that it's getting. And maybe that's why the marketing seemed to be so incendiary and they seem to be leaning into that. Is because this movie will benefit after people have seen it.
Yeah.
I don't know if describing it accurately actually has a hook. I can't tell you how to hook people if you know, if I actually like, it's about, it's sort of a meditation on photojournalism.
And like, really, it's about the reunification of Germany. No, I think that like I think it's his least successful film. Certainly
not
financially.
Do you think it's his most accessible film, though? Do you think that he is reaching, trying to go beyond maybe his core art house, to use a kind of an old fashioned term, audience, and that Civil War is basic for people who may not think about this stuff as much as us?
Do you think if more people watched Devs, he would be making better movies?
That's kind of my suggestion here, which like maybe this message is not something we need to hear, or that people who spend a lot of time reading about politics and thinking about the world need to hear. But maybe there's a lot of people in America who need to be lured into a big dumb action war movie, and that they need like the politics to be removed from the movie. You know, or like maybe they are hidden because it needs to be more politically inclusive, I guess.
Well, but it makes it more like who was on the right side in the Rwandan genocide? Do you remember? I don't. Like, I think the idea is that these conflicts happen in faraway places. And do you like who was anyone right? I don't know.
I'm gonna just let Katie spit in circles.
I know. There are many global conflicts in which the answer is that nobody is right because war is bad. Like, I think removing politics from it, maybe it makes it more accessible. But I think that like the vagueness and kind of nonsensicalness of the Western forces benefits the movie of just getting you to think, like, don't get hung up on that. Don't worry about which side you'd be on. Focus on what's actually in the present.
Isn't that defeated by, or lessened at least, by how Trump-coded the president is? I felt like it is not at all subtle because of what few details we learn about the president and how he speaks and what he's done in government and staying in a third term and disbanding the FBI, as Patrick was saying earlier. I mean, it's not hard to see who he's modeled after.
I think that's true, but could you imagine it being, it's almost vague enough where if you're like a Biden conspiracy theorist, it's that.
But no, that's ridiculous. I think that it also, it needs to be more vague if to serve Garland's point.
Then you lose it entirely.
I think that you can't have any details about the president. I don't, like, the president should be a non-factor. We should see him for the first time and hear him for the first time when he's executed in the final
He should be
scene.
Like a Muppet Babies parent. It should just be like the president's legs appear in the frame and go.
I can roll with that.
I think it's a bit too far for me. I think, adults can accept a certain degree of science fiction. And if they want to bring, real political realities to this, you can't stop them as if, they could bring real political realities to anything. Patches is like, King Kong is obviously Biden. And here's why. because he's the one trying to establish a new empire.
The scar giver is Trump.
Now you're speaking my language.
But yeah, I don't think that, I don't think Patches is doing a wrong reading of it. I think the movie's trying to provoke you into that, but I don't think it necessarily has enough footholds to say that I'm absolutely right in this interpretation. Even if, it does seem like there's only one person who's been president recently who's going to disband the FBI. That's, sort of a happenstance. If he did start working on this in 2018, as he claimed, then yeah, this is just the weirdest thing he could think about actually ended up happening. And that's more on us than it is on him.
I think we can all agree. Wagner Moura is really good at smoking cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
He does it a bunch of times this movie. Yeah. Like, should more movies have people smoking cigarettes in them?
I am so sensitive to this recently, but yeah, also Ripley, very difficult for one Dave Gonzalez, who is 29 days, 11 hours and 27
this
minutes
is what movies
nicotine
should
free.
Be good for. I want to watch people smoke lots of cigarettes so that I personally don't do that.
Well, he definitely alternates between joints and cigarettes in
That's
one
true.
scene. Passes off a joint and then immediately lights up a cigarette. And I'm like, you know what?
Like, I feel seen.
That's a style.
Yeah. If the Civil War was on, that would be me.
He also just drinks vodka all the time.
Yeah.
That feels less appealing,
I gotta say. The cocktails in Ripley are more appealing than the bottle of vodka in Civil War.
That's true. I would just be smoking my way through the American Civil War as I race from New York to Washington before it's all over. I did feel seen by that character.
If we could get Wagner Moura and Alan Ritchson in the same film, then we'd really be cooking with gas.
Civil War, it's in theaters, finally dethroned Godzilla X Kong, the new empire. Check it out, because I do think the most fun you're going to have with this movie is talking about it after you've seen it.
That does it for this week's show. We'll be back next week. We are going to be talking about Shogun, the FX limited series that's wrapping up next week. It's possible we'll be talking about The Scargiver. Some of us are more committed to seeing it than others.
Mm-hmm. Put it on the books.
Stay tuned.
That'd be Rebel Moon Part 2,
Excuse
The Scargiver.
Me.
I don't
Excuse
want anyone
me.
To get
I
it wrong when it. They search for it on
I need
Netflix.
To give it some respect. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches. I'm the executive editor at Polygon.com. I'm on Blue Sky, Letterboxd, at Mr. Patches. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to old episodes. I bet we've at least reviewed Guy Ritchie's Aladdin. We go back to that haunting film. probably some Alex Garland in the back catalog, Annihilation and Ex Machina for sure. Go listen to the old episodes, fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the chief film critic over at IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky and Instagram and Letterboxd.
At Scargiver.
At Scargiver. and you can find all of us together on Fighting in the War Room. It's a podcast. A podcast that you can review by going to the podcast app on Apple's podcast app and leaving us a review. We'll read it live on the show. Good, bad, anywhere in between. Tell us about what's going on in your head. Tell us about what's going on in your life. Or you can email us
at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name D-A-7-E, which is my handle on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd. I'm also on the Trial by Content podcast, where this week we're kicking off 3 weeks of trying to figure out what is the best baseball movie. So I've been watching some fun baseball movies. Come join me over there if you want. Katie, where are you podcasting these days?
Here. This is the only place that I'm podcasting for the time being. Although, as you might have heard, I will be starting at the Ankler at the end of April. So I will probably have a new podcast before too long. But for
what is the Ankler?
The Ankler is a Hollywood-focused newsletter service. I will be writing a newsletter about awards. You can subscribe to the Ankler and get so many different kinds of newsletters from different kinds of people, myself included. And you should do it. But I don't work there yet. So don't wait for me. Not till the end of the month. I'm also realizing as I talk, I forgot to even mention about how the Bluey episode says that in this part of Australia, if a child over 4 can ride in the front seat, and that is not legal in America. And I did have to Google it for all of my kids and their cousins who live in different states.
Not medical advice on this week's show.
This was just like, I literally Googled the state laws. Like, if in your state, a kid who is 4 or up can ride in the front seat, if the back seat is full, please write in and tell us. I gotta rewind. You can find me on social media at Katie Rich, including Letterboxd, where I reviewed Civil War, and on Instagram at Katie Rich Talking. And we are on Twitter and Blue Sky at FITWR, where please share your local state laws about children riding in the front seat, or you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was:
in honor of Abigail in theaters this weekend, what is another profession like ballerina that should be filled by a vampire?
Thanks for listening. We'll be back scargivering to you next week.
Let's go Rangers.
I'm done.